It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Wisconsin Assembly Committee is holding a hearing today calling on State Superintendent Jill Underley to testify in response to an investigation by the Capital Times into teacher misconduct cases in the state.
The Cap Times report released last week uncovered 200 teacher sexual misconduct and grooming investigations by Wisconsin educator licensing officials from 2018 to 2023.
The report has raised concerns about the way districts handle those complaints and investigations, and lawmakers and the DPI superintendent have called for changes since it came out.
Danielle Duclos is an investigative reporter for the Cap Times. Her year-long investigation sparked these proposed laws and scrutiny for the state DPI. Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you into this story in the first place?
Yeah, so I've been covering educator sexual misconduct and grooming for a while, and I actually covered one case in Green Bay when I was a reporter there. And that case showed me that there's a lot more than just one school district or one case. And so I really set out to answer the question, how often is this happening in the state of Wisconsin? And so that led me to this investigation to try to answer that question. And so the Cap Times spent the last year, as you said, looking at the investigations conducted by the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction.
What did you find about how these kind of investigations are handled?
Yes. So the department does, on average, about 113 investigations a year, and they get complaints from a variety of sources. So they get them from school districts, and they can also get them from community members as well. So parents, they also can get them from law enforcement. And so then they review that, open an investigation, and then start the fact-finding process to see if they can take the teacher's license or if they're going to close the case.
113 investigations a year, that includes more than just sexual misconduct and grooming, if I'm doing my math right.
Yes. So 113 is for all different types of misconduct. So they investigate a bunch of different types, whether that's a teacher maybe misusing school funds to physical assault, maybe hitting a child, and then also sexual misconduct and grooming.
A lot of the concerns that lawmakers have had since your reporting is about transparency, I guess, is the key word here. What happens to those reports? What happens to that information after that investigation is launched? What are some of the concerns you ran into?
Yeah, so the Cap Times obtained this information via public records requests. And so how we did our data analysis is we requested the Department of Public Instruction's internal case tracking document that has all their investigations that they've conducted going back to 2018, which is why we started with that year. And then we stopped at 2023, which is where most of the information was at the time we obtained the document. Mm-hmm. And so we started coding that conduct based on internal definitions by the Department of Public Instruction and started to categorize. And there's just a lot of case files. You have to go and ask for individual educator case files if you want information about a specific educator or more in depth. And the Cap Times did do that. We asked for 10 case files in April to see how long it would take to get that. And to put that in perspective, 10 case files, right, is less than 10% of their annual average caseload. And it took until September for us to get those 10 files back, so over 4 months. So access to that information is takes some time.
And in an updated piece that came out yesterday, you looked into what happens when you go to districts themselves. How easy is it to get that kind of information at that level?
That was a little surprising. We had some very big prices that districts wanted to charge. The Janesville School District wanted to charge $245,000 to provide these types of records from 2017 through January of 2025. And obviously, the Cap Times does not quite have that money to pay for that. And then the Middleton School District wanted more than $40,000. The Madison School District wanted more than $4,000. And so it adds up over time. They are not necessarily organizing these records in a way that's super easy to find them. A lot of districts were saying they'd have to hand inspect every single personnel file to find these records.
Now, people hear sexual misconduct and grooming. What kind of behaviors are you seeing? A few examples of the cases you saw that are turning up in these investigations.
Yeah, so sexual misconduct and grooming is a broad spectrum of behaviors. And as Dr. Carol Shakeshaft, a researcher who's been studying this for decades, defines it, it includes physical, verbal, visual, and electronic behaviors. So it can be anything from actual abuse, and then it can also be things that are boundary crossings that reflect more of a peer-to-peer relationship rather than that of a student and teacher. So that can be things like spending excessive time outside of school, one-on-one, alone and isolated, not affiliated with educational activities, things like that.
Mm-hmm. The obvious concern here is if a teacher is investigated, leaves that job, do they keep their license? Or even if they lose their license, can they get other jobs? with access to kids. What kind of things are in place that that follow that teacher? What kind of things aren't in place?
Right. So if an educator loses their license in the state of Wisconsin, whether it's revoked by the state or they voluntarily give their license up, there is a public license status lookup run by the Department of Public Instruction. So you can search that educator's name and see the current status of their license. So it says, is it active? Is it currently under investigation? Did they give up their license? Is it revoked? But that's all the information that's there. The why is missing. And that was something that the advocates and prevention, the prevention advocates and researchers I spoke with were concerned about, is that the reason why someone lost their license isn't as easily accessible. The Department of Public Instruction does report when someone loses their license to a private database that's nationwide, so that if an educator goes to another state and tries to get a teaching license, that information is available. But it's not available to the general public. And so the researchers and folks I was speaking with for the story raised concern about working with kids in non-licensed roles, right? Maybe you go work at a summer camp, or maybe as a private coach for recreational sports or something like that.
I could see a teacher saying, well, hold on now. I was accused. I was investigated. I say wrongfully. I was never charged. I was never convicted. Why should that follow me around in my records and possibly ruin my chances of employment in the future? On the privacy side, for a person accused, not convicted, what kind of concerns did you see raised?
For not convicted, so do you mean someone who has kept their license and was...
Well, these things haven't been proven in a court of law. I say I was falsely accused in these cases, so why should this information follow me? Would be a concern I could see a teacher raising.
Right. So if someone loses their license or it's taken by the state, something that the researchers or advocates I was speaking with, for a prevention standpoint, understanding why, and also... you know, in the part two that came out yesterday, the government transparency advocates I spoke with, you know, there's interest in understanding how the government, whether it's Department of Public Instruction or individual school districts, are conducting these investigations, right? And it raises that point as well that you brought up, is are these investigations being conducted thoroughly and fairly on both ends of the spectrum?
We're talking to Danielle Duclos, reporter at the Cap Times, looking at her reporting on accusations, investigations of teacher sexual misconduct and grooming, how they're handled. And Danielle, since your first report came out, a lot of response. State lawmakers saying, hey, we need to change some stuff here. What are you hearing from them? What are they starting to get rolling?
Yeah, so Representative Amanda Nedweski has said that she's drafting some legislation. It's hard to say what that'll look like in practice without seeing the actual introduced bill text. But one of the things that she mentioned was preventing educators from being able to voluntarily surrender their licenses in order to close an investigation with the Department of Public Instruction. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and how you know, lawmakers talk about that. As I mentioned earlier, the conversations I was having with these prevention advocates and researchers for this story was more around the transparency about why someone lost their license and having that information available. And as mentioned in the reporting, the Department of the Wisconsin Department of Safety and Professional Services, which oversees hundreds of other state licensed professionals, doctors, architects, accountants, landscape architects, didn't know that was a job until I started this reporting. You can look up there if they've lost a license, why, and any other disciplinary actions taken against their licenses in a public lookup.
The state's Department of Public Instruction, obviously at the center of this story. You've gotten various responses from the superintendent, Jill Underley. The sequence of things you heard in response from her office.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Cap Times stands by its reporting. We asked Dr. Underley for an interview prior to publication, and since she released her statement, we asked her for another interview, and she declined that. She said she's open to a long overdue conversation about licensing and how these investigations are conducted, so I'm interested to see where that conversation goes and what lawmakers have to say and what goes from here.
In your first report, another something that came up was resources at the Department of Public Instruction to do those investigations many a year. What do those resources look like?
Yeah, so the Department of Public Instruction has one full-time investigator and then one part-time investigator doing those 113 cases on average each year. And they said that that's not enough. And the researchers I spoke with also raised alarm at that. They also talked about the Department of Public Instruction mentioned having their funding cut consistently and not having enough funding to update their licensing software and do things like that. So under-resourced in terms of staffing as well as funding.
looking at other states, and I'm guessing some lawmakers are doing that right about now, and you talked to some advocates as well. What are examples from other states that could be on the table here in Wisconsin?
Yes, so the CapTimes is going to have reporting coming out looking exactly at that, so don't want to put the cart before the horse, but some things in terms of transparency, like Arizona, Pennsylvania, Idaho, they put out annual reports looking at the data. So something that one of the researchers I spoke with, Billie Jo Grant, she's a prevention trainer as well as a researcher on sexual misconduct in schools. She said that understanding the scale of a problem is really important in order to allocate solutions, right? How much is in funding is needed? What's actually needed to solve this problem? And so having more data would be really helpful. So these other states like Arizona actually breaks down to how many investigations they conducted, what counties are those complaints coming from, what types of conduct are they investigating, the outcomes of those investigations. And that data would be probably very helpful for Wisconsin to also have.
So we've got a hearing in the state legislature today. You're looking ahead at what other states are doing. Where is your reporting going from here? Or what are you watching for next in the story?
Yeah, so we have a few more installments of the series coming out over the next month. And then I'm also going to be monitoring what happens in the legislature and what conversations evolve and how those are changing and what the Department of Public Instruction has to say as they ask for changes.
It's still early days in the legislative response. Are you seeing Republican versus Democrat on this, or are you seeing some bipartisan interest in changes here?
That's something that I asked Representative Nidweski when I talked to her about the bills that she's drafting, and it's really early, obviously, and so the conversations are just starting, and so it'll be interesting to see how those unfold.
Danielle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Been talking to Danielle Duclos, investigative reporter for the Cap Times. She was with us today to share her reporting on how the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction handles cases of teacher sexual misconduct and grooming. You can follow her reporting at the Cap Times. And if you have questions about how these things work, if you've encountered a situation like this, maybe as a student, a teacher, a parent in your own district, let us know. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, COVID infections are still spreading. Federal guidance created confusion about who should get a COVID booster. Now an economist has data on how COVID shots protect households.
So if a kid in the family is vaccinated, that protects the kid. And for every kid case of COVID you prevent, that prevents about half a case of COVID in the rest of the family.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Flu season's here. A winter uptick in COVID-19 could be around the corner, and people in Wisconsin are making the decision whether or not to get vaccinated against these very contagious respiratory illnesses.
According to state immunization data, the number of people in Wisconsin who received a COVID vaccine in September is down about 33% compared to that month last year. And for flu shots, uptake is down 5% for September.
A forthcoming study co-written by a UW-Madison economist finds evidence that COVID vaccines significantly reduce the spread of the disease within households.
Dan Sachs is the Leslie P. Schultz Professor of Risk Management and Insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business. He studies the economics of health, and his findings will be published in the American Economic Journal in January. Dan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of question did you set out to answer when you started this research on COVID-19 vaccine uptake and the spin-off consequences of vaccines?
Yeah, we started thinking about this project in early 2022. So the vaccines had been around for about a year. It was pretty clear from the clinical trials that they worked in the sense that if I got vaccinated, it would protect me. But there was a big question, which was, how much does it protect other people around me? And a lot of organizations were requiring people to be vaccinated before they could come in. States sometimes had vaccine mandates. And at the same time, there was intense pushback about this. And the motivation behind all of it was these what we call indirect effects. How much does it protect other people? And we really didn't know. That's what we wanted to learn.
So you zoom in on the indirect effects of the COVID-19 vaccine. What stands out to you in the research?
So we start by looking at what happens in a household, essentially, when the kids get vaccinated. The reason we're looking at the kids is that they were kind of the last to be eligible for the vaccines. And so we can compare what happens to families with kids who became eligible because of their age versus families with just younger kids who aren't yet eligible. We think that's a very convincing comparison. There's not a lot of other factors that could be different between those families. And we find pretty substantial protective effects for families. So if a kid in the family is vaccinated, that protects the kid. And for every kid case of COVID you prevent, that prevents about half a case of COVID in the rest of the family.
We've had a number of COVID boosters since then, since you started this research. Is it still applicable, your findings?
So our findings are definitely looking at kids who are getting their first COVID shot. Mm-hmm. So we're learning the indirect effects for them. We find protection for the people in their household. And it probably won't surprise you that for the families that vaccinate their kids, mostly the parents are already vaccinated. So we're finding fewer breakthrough infections, protection for family members who are themselves already vaccinated. So in that sense, there's some reason to think that this continues to apply. Certainly, there are many people out there who have not gotten even one COVID shot or not gotten one in a while. It could well apply to them. That said, there is a big kind of lingering question for all the COVID vaccines, which is how effective is the third, fourth, fifth booster? I think mm-hmm. that's still an open question, especially for these indirect effects.
What happens when the kids are at school? Is there still that type of effect of giving that type of insulation from COVID?
Yeah, so I have two young kids at home, mm-hmm. and they sneeze all over me. It's no surprise that their vaccines protect me. But we also wondered, what about less close contacts? So, you know, people that you don't interact with face-to-face super often. And the way that we studied this was looking at schools. And in Indiana, where our data are from, some 12-year-olds, that's the youngest age group eligible for the vaccines, will go to middle schools where most kids can get vaccinated because they're older than 12. But some go to elementary schools where almost no one is vaccinated because they're all younger. And we wanted to see, is there some protective effect of having more vaccinated kids in your school? And here we found no. We didn't really see any protective effect. Maybe there's a small effect that we just didn't have enough data to pick up. That was a bit surprising to us. The way that we think about it is, again, maybe there's a small effect that we're not able to pick up. Maybe there's no effect. That's certainly possible, especially because there were a lot of mitigation measures in place. So schools, for example, staggered the start times of classes, so kids in different classes didn't mix too closely. And then another possibility is that, you know, what we're measuring is sometimes called herd immunity, like how much protection do we get collectively when more people are vaccinated or otherwise have immunity. And epidemiologists often think you need a lot of vaccination before you get to this herd immunity level. And schools in Indiana just did not have very high vaccination rates. So even in the high vaccination rate schools, maybe 30% of kids were vaccinated. So it's possible there just wasn't enough vaccination going around.
And can you explain why you used Indiana data?
Well, you know, there's a joke about a drunk person looking for his keys under a spot under a streetlight. And that's not where he lost them, but that's where the light is. And economists are guilty of this, too. So we look at Indiana mainly because we have excellent data from Indiana. So we work with a healthcare informatics group that's closely associated with Indiana University called the Reagan Streif Institute that also has longstanding ties with the state and helped them put up COVID dashboards. So for Indiana, we had data on almost all COVID tests and almost all COVID vaccinations linked to medical records. So we could really study this group in detail. You know, I lived in Indiana for 8 years. It's a great state. It's not that I think that this is the only place to study this, but we had the data. In some ways, Indiana is also helpful because it's kind of a middle-of-the-road vaccination rate state, and they had a very strict age-based rollout of the COVID vaccine. So some states prioritized, like, healthcare workers or people with particular conditions or other groups. Here, it was really just age, so it was a clean setting for our study, too.
Here in Wisconsin, we don't know yet whether there will be a seasonal COVID-19 wave this winter. We know virus is circulating. Do you have evidence from your research that might affect people's behavior toward getting a COVID booster now?
I think the COVID booster is a real decision. I think that many people experience short but real side effects of getting it. So I think that there's some reason not to want to vaccinate. I think most people recognize also that there's a health benefit of getting a COVID vaccine or COVID booster, which is that COVID is also a nasty illness and like you don't want to experience that. What our research adds is two things. I think some people are not sure how much the COVID vaccines work like in the real world outside of the clinical setting. And, you know, we found that they were very effective for the kids who got them. The second is that a lot of the current kind of guidance around the COVID boosters focuses on personal risks and personal decisions. That's an appropriate framework. But one thing that it misses is you might want to get vaccinated, not just to protect yourself, but to protect your family and people that you interact with closely. And we have some evidence, at least, that in the past, that was a real effect of the COVID vaccines.
You know, along those lines, a Pew Research survey from March, it found that more Americans reported getting a flu shot than an updated COVID-19 vaccine. And so if both vaccines are readily available, why might uptake be different with these two vaccines?
That is also a thing that I've seen in my data, and it's quite clear that more people are getting the flu vaccine than the COVID vaccine. In other research I've done on vaccines, it seems that people worry a lot about how effective the vaccine is, but also these even just short-run side effects. And there is definitely a perception that the COVID vaccine has a bit more of a punch than the flu vaccine. So I believe that that is one contributing factor. The COVID vaccines are also newer. They're based on an mRNA technology. As far as I've seen, there's no reason to doubt the safety of that technology, and it has many promises for its ability to develop new vaccines very quickly should new pandemics emerge. But there's also a lot of discomfort with that newer technology.
So as we enter flu and COVID season, now is the time people are making that decision whether or not to get vaccinated, making a decision about their child and vaccinations. How do COVID vaccination rates this year so far compare to previous years? What's standing out to you about immunization data here in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So the COVID vaccination rates are down, at least based on last month's data. Still waiting for October to come in. I suspect that a big reason for that has to do with changing federal guidelines around vaccinations. So up until this year, the CDC recommended that everyone 6 months and older get a COVID vaccine. Now they say, we recommend that you make a personal decision, and we really only endorse it for people with certain risk factors or 65 and older. And some pharmacists have reported that that makes them not sure whether they can stock and distribute the vaccines as easily. I haven't seen that it's been a huge challenge for people to get vaccines, but it's definitely slowed down. So vaccination rates are about 30% lower this year than they were in 2024 for COVID in particular.
We're talking with Dan Sachs, professor in risk management and insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business, and he co-authored this study which found that COVID vaccination significantly reduces the spread of the disease within households. We also are seeing some confusion this season about vaccine guidance and whether it will be covered, the vaccine, COVID vaccine will be covered through insurance. What are you learning about the retail cost of the vaccine and whether insurance companies are picking up the tab?
Yeah, so a lot of the uncertainty here was that insurers have to cover a vaccine if this important committee, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, endorses it. They did not uniformly endorse the COVID vaccine, but that doesn't mean that insurers can't cover it. And in fact, insurers seem to be covering it without exception, as far as I have seen. So, you know, patients are not having to pay out of pocket for the COVID vaccines, despite the fact that it is not uniformly endorsed by this committee.
And full disclosure, when I got my COVID booster, the person who gave it to me, the nurse said, and by the way, if your insurance doesn't cover it, you will be billed X amount of dollars. I think it was like $129 or something like that. So there was that disclaimer right before I got the COVID booster. Is that something you're seeing?
Well, when I look at the data and see this decline in vaccinations, there's many factors that might contribute to it. But I think a concern that a lot of people have raised is that this kind of ambiguous guidance has discouraged vaccinations, even though it's still possible to go out and get a vaccination. And there's a lot of ways that, you know, people can be discouraged. But someone telling you, by the way, there's a chance you'll have to pay $130 is a pretty strong discouragement. And it may well turn some people off.
Where does your research go next? What are you looking at with this data or other data sets?
So I am really interested in what people believe about these vaccines and how those beliefs affect their decisions to vaccinate or not. So one thing that I've learned through surveys is, people are very sensitive to what they believe the effectiveness of these vaccines to be and how severe they think the side effects are. And looking at the flu vaccine, we find people are actually pretty accurate about the effectiveness. So flu vaccine is only moderately effective. People seem to know that. Where they're too pessimistic is about the side effects. So especially people who are hesitant to vaccinate, they expect to have really severe side effects of vaccination, much worse than what we see in the clinical trials of the vaccines. So we're interested in whether better information about the side effects might shift people's beliefs and persuade some to vaccinate.
I keep going back to your area of expertise in health economics and think about, how do vaccines and health risk management fit into the business world? And what is the business sense here?
Yeah. We studied this in part because it's just deeply interesting to us, but vaccines are also a textbook example, an economics textbook example of what we call an externality. So, most interactions that people have mainly matter for the two people in that interaction. So you go to the pharmacy and get your heart disease medication, that's between you and the pharmacist. Vaccines are potentially different because if you get vaccinated, that's not just between you and the pharmacist. Now that's between everyone you interact with who you might spread disease to. So economists usually think that government support of vaccines is warranted because we want to encourage people to get these benefits for everyone else when they vaccinate. So we were interested in measuring that. That's an economics answer more than a business answer, but it is also true that businesses both need a healthy workforce, people coming in, and in fact, many businesses at least set up on-site flu vaccine clinics because they believe that they'll have a healthier workforce if more of them are vaccinated. And then we saw, especially during COVID, that restaurants and bars and social places both may have themselves believed that having more vaccinated patrons kept everyone safer. But definitely for many people, there was a fear of going out and socializing because they were afraid that they might get COVID. And if everyone else around them was also vaccinated, they might be more willing to come in. So understanding these indirect effects of vaccines, I think, is quite important for many business decisions.
And you mentioned like having a flu clinic at someone's office or right down the street or right outside their building. How much of a role does accessibility play in the decision of whether to get a vaccine for you or for your child?
It seems to me that for many adults making vaccine decisions, that accessibility is not so important in the sense that accessibility is already very high. So most people at least report that they live near a pharmacy, they could get vaccinated if they wanted to. On the other hand, there's other evidence that if you bring your kids into the doctor's office for their checkup and it's October, so a flu shot is available, they're very likely to get the flu shot. If you bring them in August, no flu shots available, they're much less likely to get it. And so some combination of like it's accessible, it's right there, and you're in a healthcare provider's office at the right time does make a difference.
You mentioned flu season in Wisconsin, which is typically starting this month and really peaks in December through February. What do you notice about flu vaccination rates this season in Wisconsin?
Flu vaccination rates to me in Wisconsin, and as far as I can tell for the country as a whole, look pretty similar to what we've seen in the past. So for the country as a whole, there's no data being updated right now because of the shutdown, I think.
Yeah.
But the last I checked, we were kind of a couple weeks behind schedule, which is consistent with a slightly later advisory committee meeting. For Wisconsin, it looks very similar to past years. So basically on track. I don't see a lot of disruption there.
And finally, based on all of this research that you have done on the direct and indirect effects of the COVID-19 vaccine, do any particular public policy ideas stand out to you that would really influence how a state and their health could be, and what policy decisions could come out of this?
Well, we ended up finding the clearest effects at fairly narrow areas, so in households, and I suspect that's what we know for sure. I suspect that something similar happens among, for example, coworkers who work closely together. And so, you know, what that tells me is that there's a pretty strong case for groups of people who interact closely together to decide, you know, it's important that we all vaccinate. In the past, especially at the tail end of the pandemic, some states started proposing laws to make it illegal for an employer to require vaccination. And our results say that those laws would have real costs, that you could, if you wanted to, promote the health of your employees, particularly if they wanted it, by requiring them all to vaccinate. And bans on employer vaccine mandates undermine that.
Dan, thank you for sharing your research.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Sachs is a professor of risk management and insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business. He talked with us about his study that explores how COVID vaccination affects the spread of the disease within households.
Coming up, we visit the workshop of a Wisconsin artist who makes unique book art that can change the way we think about books.
The reader really has to interact with the book in various ways. They're not just turning pages, but doing other actions in order to find the content.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In general, we know how books work, right? You open them, read from left to right, top to bottom, page by page. But in a Wisconsin workshop, things are different, and physical books become pieces of art.
Works of book art often have movable structures, three-dimensional aspects, and a lot more than words, paper, and spine. And they tell stories in surprising ways.
Here in Wisconsin, Julie Chen is a world-renowned book artist and professor at UW-Madison and creator of Flying Fish Press. Over her 30-year career, she's created hundreds of pieces that have been shown around the globe. Producer Mackenzie Crummy and I joined Julie in her Madison studio for a close-up look at how book art is made. Julie, for people not familiar with that concept, they might think, okay, books, sure, they could be artistic, but book art, how do you explain that to people who are not familiar with it?
Okay, well, in order to explain book art, I have to first explain that there are two versions of that phrase. One is book art, and the other one is book arts that has an S at the end of the word art. And the difference is the book arts with an S refer to all the craft and technique that goes into making books. So that includes things such as letterpress printing, book binding, paper making, all of those things that would create the printed page or put the pages together into a book. Those are the book arts. That also would include printmaking and other types of media that people use in books. Book art is when an artist uses the book as a medium for creating a work of art. So it may seem like I'm splitting hairs a little bit, but the difference between book art without an S and book art with an S is kind of a big deal in the book art world.
What's striking me is it's a really unique experience. With a book that I'm going to read, mm-hmm. I read left to right, top to bottom, then turn the page. If there is a sculpture, generally the sculpture is just sitting there. I can look at it from different angles maybe. A book art, though, it moves, right? There are moving mm-hmm. pieces, and they have to move for me to understand it, like I'm turning the pages of a book. I'm kind of trying to wrap my head around this unique experience.
Right. So the other term that we use in book art is artist book. So we refer to sort of the field of artist books or people who make artist books or all the activity that goes into making an artist book as book art. But what we're actually making, the end result, the book, is called an artist book. And not all artist books are as interactive as mine are. Some people use the standard codex format, which is the type of book that you would, you know, go to the bookstore and buy a book and turn the pages and read that book. And they make really amazing books that way. For me, I'm often using non-traditional book structures that are kind of hard to explain on the radio, but but the reader really has to interact with the book in various ways. They're not just turning pages, but doing other actions in order to find the content. I'm going to put this aside. This is one of my most recent works. It's called A Monument to What Remains, and it's a really big box. And when you flip it open, it's actually two boxes side by side that are housed together. And then inside the boxes, there are six very skinny accordion books with very large type. The whole text on this side says, "This is a monument to the fragility of memory." And then if you keep flipping through the book, there's another phrase on the opposite side. And for this book, the phrase on this side says, "We honor those who were unthanked and unnamed." And the idea for this book came from my interest in public monuments, and especially in the last few years where a lot of Civil War monuments are being taken down. And it really got me thinking about who gets to decide what gets memorialized and what doesn't. I had a friend who had gone to Vietnam. He wasn't injured, but his life was really not the same. I'm standing at the Vietnam Memorial and I'm thinking, well, where's his monument? He served his country. He didn't die, so he doesn't get to be on the wall. But his life was affected for the remainder of his life. And so I started to really think about, if I was going to create a monument, what would it be? So a lot of the text, all of the phrases in these six books are things that wouldn't get memorialized. They're things from everyday life and little failures and little things that weren't, you know, you wouldn't get a trophy for, you wouldn't get a monument for. And so after you read all six books, so there's three more on this side, you can open them up, fan them out sort of like an accordion, a zigzag pattern. So you set these discs into all the slots, and then you can put all the books on top of each other and you can create a big wall. So it's a book that becomes a monument, and the reader has the ability to choose what order and what side of the book appears together. So it's sort of like they're making a physical monument, but they're also having some control over what the monument says.
What goes into creating the concept that leads to the creation of a piece of book art for you?
So in my work, it always starts out with something that I'm interested in. Maybe something I hear about in the news, or something that I hear about repeatedly in the news, you know, such as global warming. Something that happens to me in my personal life that's just a personal experience that I'm trying to work my way through. Whatever it is, it's a long process for me of thinking about what it is I'm trying to say. And then there is a research component where I try to find books about the topic that I think I'm interested in making a book about. Usually that leads to other topics, you know, one thing leads to another. And it turns out that what I'm trying to say might not be what I thought I wanted to say at first. So I do that research, and I'm taking notes, and I'm thinking about I'm always thinking about what kind of experience I'm trying to give the reader ultimately. And that helps bring me back to what is it that I'm trying to say.
Now, one thing I'm curious about is, okay, if I do a sculpture, I've mm-hmm. made one sculpture,
yes.
probably. If I get a book published, I'm going to, well, if it's me, probably 10 copies, but dozens, if I'm Stephen King, you know, yeah. millions of copies. I don't know. How many copies of a particular piece of book art might you make? Are each unique? Do you do a run of more than one? I don't know.
Yeah, so I make editions. I've always made editions since the very beginning. In the early days of Flying Fish Press, which is the name of my imprint, I would make 100 copies of a book. And as my books became more and more labor intensive to put together, that started to become less feasible because it would take me years to put together the whole editions because so much handwork goes into putting these complex structures together. So now I make about 30 copies, between 20 and 30 copies in my editions. And that still takes quite a long time to put those copies together.
Right, because most of the steps, as I look at the work, these are clearly not things you could automate easily. Maybe the printing, once you have the basic thing that you're mm-hmm. going to put on your letterpress, that's easy to make multiple copies
yes.
of. But I think that's the only part that's easy to reproduce quickly.
Yeah, that's the easiest part. Once you have the design that you're going to print, and in my case, I'm using the computer to do digital design that I then have plates made, mm-hmm. like physical relief plates made that I can then print on my printing press. Okay, so we're in my studio in Art Lofts at UW-Madison. I have a lot of tables where I work assembling my books, and I have a huge number of flat files because all of the book parts have to be housed somewhere. And so for all the editions, there are drawers and drawers that are full of parts of books that haven't been assembled yet. 20 drawers here, I've got, you know, 30 drawers here, I've got 10 drawers in the front of the room. So these are all like parts of books. So if you open up the drawer, you'll see partially processed parts that are going to go into the finished book. But I've got many, many drawers full of parts. And in addition to all of those things, I have my printing press, so I can turn that on. You can hear it. So it sounds like that. So let's say you have a photopolymer plate or wood type, it would be on the bed, and these rollers would have ink on them. Okay, so then this whole assembly rolls over here, so the type gets inked up, and then the paper that you would be printing would be wrapped around the cylinder, and so then this rolls forward, and the paper rolls over whatever is on the bed, and then with a switch, we roll it back.
Your press is Flying Fish Press.
Flying
Where
Fish
did the name come from?
Yeah, that's not a very interesting story, but I'll tell you the story. So when I was in graduate school, like I said, I didn't really know anything about fine press or about making editions, but everybody had a press name. So I had to pick a press name, and I'm trying to think, well, what are other people's press names? And a lot of press names are maybe named after different animals or plants or mythological creatures. And I thought, okay, I need to pick out something that will represent what I'm planning to do. And at that time, I didn't know what I was going to really be doing. So I chose the flying fish. And at the time, I have to really be honest and say there was just something very elegant and kind of interesting about the idea of a flying fish. And it wasn't until later that I kind of came up with a story that kind of went with that name, which is that the flying fish kind of really is successful because it spends a lot of time between the elements. It lives in the water, but it keeps itself safe by leaping out of the water into the air. And I kind of like that idea once I came up with this concept of what I was trying to do was sort of in between two worlds, and that I was going to sort of exist doing this work that wasn't traditional, but it wasn't also, you know, super experimental. It was kind of right in the margin between those two things.
it's an interesting medium, I guess. It's conceptual and kind of like brainy on the one hand, but it's very practical, right? You got to make sure your press is functioning,
yes,
and you're, I assume, hand stitching your mm-hmm. binding and things like that. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the appeal to you, that it is this very thoughtful thing, but yet a very hands-on practical art at the same time?
Yes, definitely the craft part of it is really important to me. When I think about my own work, I'm always thinking about a physical object. There's no reason why I couldn't switch over and do digital work. I use the computer a lot in my design. So why not make videos? Why not make things that just exist, you know, on a screen? Well, I'm not a programmer, so I would have to learn how to do that. But the point I'm trying to make is that the physical object is a really important part of how I understand my work and how it exists in the world. And so the craft elements are a really important part of that.
Now, it can be a little tricky for people to interact with book art in the world. You mentioned the library at UW-Madison has things where the public can make appointments and come in. Can you make the case for people who are saying, yeah, this sounds super cool, to go out and check it out in hopefully a library not too far from them?
Yes, I would definitely encourage everyone to go to the Kohler Art Library here on the UW-Madison campus. And you can look up their artist book collection online. They have an artist book database that has photos as well as descriptions of the book, and you can type in keywords. So if you wanted to look at pop-up books, just type in pop-up book and it will give you a list of artist books that use pop-ups. And so that might be something that then you would see something in a photograph and say, oh, I really want to see that. The reason I would encourage everyone to go to a library to see artist books is it really isn't an interactive experience. You can't really just look at a book in an exhibition the way you might look at a painting or a sculpture. You have to interact with it, and you have to be able to read it page by page, or maybe whatever the structure
causes you to do,
that the content in a book is going to be revealed over time. So it's really a time-based medium that's more like film or theater than it is like other visual arts like sculpture and painting, which are not necessarily time-based. And so the only way to really experience a book, an artist book, is to go to a library or a collection and actually interact with that book.
Julie, thanks a lot for sharing your work with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Julie Chen is an internationally known book artist who has been publishing limited edition artist books under the Flying Fish Press imprint for over 30 years. She's a professor of book art at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks to Sarah Hopeful for sound design on that piece. We've also got some pictures from our visit to Julie's workshop. Those will be going up at WPR.org in the next day or two. And remember, you can follow lots of great stories, from breaking news to community events to cool stuff people are doing all around Wisconsin. Head to WPR.org and bookmark it for future visits. And you can sign up for the Wisconsin Today morning newsletter. You can subscribe to that online. It's real easy. WPR.org/newsletters. And you'll get lots of great Wisconsin stuff in your inbox every weekday morning. Next week, Green Bay's own Tony Shalhoub joins the show. He's got a documentary series called Breaking Bread on CNN, focusing on food and bringing people together. And there's an episode coming up set in Wisconsin.
He shares a meal with his family, cooks savory s'mores with a Wisconsin cheesemaker, and makes grilled cheese sandwiches at Lambeau Field with Packers legend Leroy Butler.
And we want to know about your favorite foods to share with other people, whether it's a favorite meal you have with your family or maybe a local food favorite.
Tell us what food has a special meaning for you and your family or your community. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can give us a call and send us a text at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Beatrice Lawrence, and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.